One of the great things about being an editor for the last 12 years and not writing a book, the last book I wrote was about Muhammad Ali, and as soon as this was being published, I became, by circumstances too bizarre to get into here, the editor of the New Yorker magazine, after having been the only editing experience I had was as the editor of the Pascack Valley Smoke Signal newspaper, and you know it. You know that newspaper. It came out twice a year, and I did it on my kitchen table. It was very, very good. And I wrote all the articles myself and changed the names, which I still do at the New Yorker. It's an astonishing thing. I am Malcolm Gladwell. I am unbelievably rich. I haven't written a book in 12 years, and for some insane reason, because this job, being the editor of a magazine that I really love, takes up some time. And the way this all got started is once in a while, once or twice a year, I write a piece for the magazine almost as a way to get out of the house so that I'm not just wearing a deep groove between where I live in the West 80s and Times Square, to get out of the house a little bit, to see some part of the world, to speak to some other people other than my esteemed colleagues. I go write a piece, and it's for me, it's health. It suits me a lot better than a week at the beach or 2 weeks at the beach. I'm not very good at that. So something unfortunate happened, something, in fact, tragic for The New Yorker happened after I published this piece. Our writer, probably the writer of greatest reputation who's ever been a consistent staff writer for The New Yorker, John Updike, died. And John's funeral was at the Episcopal Church on the North Shore, north of Boston, on the water. And I went there with my colleague Henry Finder to the funeral. Henry had been his editor for quite a long time. And after the funeral was over, I stayed an extra couple of days in Cambridge, Massachusetts, near Harvard. And as a kind of thought experiment, I dug up a lot of Obama's, or some of Obama's, law school professors, particularly Lawrence Tribe, who's a constitutional specialist, Martha Minow, who else? David Wilkins, Charles Ogletree, and maybe one or two others. Just to see if all the pieces that I had read, and there have been so many of them, there had been 2 years worth of journalism on Obama, really intensified journalism, some of it good, some of it not so good, some of it wonderful, some of it horrible, if there was anything more to learn about this guy. And I sat down with Larry Tribe, who was Barack Obama's main mentor, and spoke with him for a few hours, and Martha Minow and all these others, and really started to see something about Obama at Harvard Law that I didn't think I knew already. In other words, the worst thing you can tell as an author to an audience is a story that they feel they've known already. So that was one challenge. The other challenge is that for the first time, we have a president of the United States that I would hire as a staff writer. I don't think that can be said of his predecessor so much. And I have a great deal of respect for Bill Clinton, but I also read his memoir, and I think he was a better president than he was a memoir writer. The first half of that book was very good, and then suddenly, in my humble opinion, it becomes a kind of gigantic desk calendar of his presidency. The part about his childhood is quite interesting. But Obama has a writer's temperament. He likes to be alone a fair amount. He likes the process of writing. He likes being alone with his thoughts and transferring them to paper. And he was a writer before he was a politician. Most political autobiographies are written in retrospect, after the person has held office, after that person wants to put a very good spin on his or her time in office. There's motivation for it. And a lot of political autobiographies are just sheer bullshit. I mean, they're a kind of, here's my plan for when I am president, and this is why I am so unbelievably wonderful. And it's a kind of, it's not writing, it's public relations. Barack Obama's book is not public relations. Barack Obama, and I'm talking about the first book in particular, Barack Obama's memoir is a really interesting book about one thing, which, and books, if they're successful, can accomplish maybe one thing. And what it accomplished was the telling of a story about someone who had a, if not unique, then fairly unusual background, and someone pursuing identity. Who am I? I look in the mirror, I don't look anything like my mother or my grandparents who were raising me. Who am I? Who is this father figure that is absolutely absent from my life, about whom I've heard stories, but I don't really know? He's a mythological figure in my life. And he goes on a journey. This is a classic autobiographical, and in particular, but not limited to, African-American autobiographical frame. Someone in pursuit of self. We see it in slave narratives. We see it in the autobiography of Malcolm X. We see it in Richard Wright and James Baldwin. I'm obviously not just limited to African Americans, but this is a very self-conscious frame he has in writing this book. And it ends before politics. This book is published before he has run for anything. So to the degree to which a book can be independent of the public life, that's what Barack Obama wrote. And I think it's a very good book. Maybe it's overvalued at this point. We talk of it in terms of, as if he's, sometimes we go too far, as if he's eclipsed Twain or Richard Wright or whoever it is, but it is certainly a very good book, and it's a book that became an important book in the culture because of who Barack Obama turned out to be. That's another challenge that somebody in my shoes, and I'm not the only one, faced. And I faced it happily, and once the reporting began and I began to speak to more and more and more and more people, and the better sources were at this level rather than at that level, because they're not spinning, they're speaking honestly, I thought I had a book on my hands, even though it had to be accomplished on certain crevices and fringes of the time of being an editor. And what I discovered was somebody that was immensely deep as a political figure, somebody whose entrance into political life was enormously complicated, and I wanted to tell that story. And I also wanted to figure out how, we forget it now because we're deep into this presidency and we go from issue to issue and debate to debate and fight to fight. When you look back on it, it's an extraordinary thing. Extraordinary not only because his name is what his name is, and at certain points in Obama's political career, political consultants told him, you know, maybe you ought to change your name. Really. And not only extraordinary because he's the first non-WASP, except for John Kennedy, to be elected president, not just extraordinary because he's African-American and this is the longest-running wound and epic of American life, but also extraordinary because he was a U.S. senator for 5 minutes. 5 minutes before the questions began, are you and when are you going to run for president? And of course, as all new senators do, when they're asked questions like that, they immediately discounted it and said this is an impossibility. But Obama did it for a variety of reasons that we can talk about tonight. And won. In other words, we forget how epical we are. So swept up in the ebb and flow of events, and the screaming and yelling between Fox and MSNBC and all the things that the media that you and I consume, like sugar addicts or heroin addicts, or how, depends on how bad your addiction is, that we forget that something radical happened in American life. That the most radical thing about Barack Obama, as Henry Louis Gates says, is the fact that he is an African-American, he was elected president. This seems like an accomplished fact, but to me it's something that is present in our everyday political life right now. When you hear people in the Tea Party movement saying, I want my country back, I've lost my country, something is being said there very often that has to do with race. It has to do with otherness. that has to do with a nostalgia for an imagined America some time ago. And this is in direct opposition to what James Baldwin said in the midst, not of the Obama, obviously James Baldwin didn't live to see this, but what James Baldwin said in 1984 after the first Jesse Jackson campaign. And there is no Barack Obama without Jesse Jackson, no matter what you think of Jesse Jackson. And in, I think it's Notes from a Native Son, I could be wrong, but from memory, James Baldwin wrote that America is white no longer. America is white no longer, which means what? It means that this country is changing, that it's changing demographically, that the youngest voters in the country are the least white. And no, and not only did Barack Obama not win the majority of the white vote, neither did John Kerry, that there, this is something deeply important in the transformation of American life. So in this book, and really, I hate making speeches. I think you don't love hearing speeches. So I mainly want to answer your questions and have a discussion with you. But what this book is about, what this book tries to accomplish, is to tell at once a story of a person, sort of a young person, relatively young person. I say relatively young because he's 2 years younger than me, and it makes me feel good. Two or three, I may be pushing it. I'm not quite. How old is Obama? 48? 48. All right, 2.5. Thanks. And it's somebody who does not have a deep, long political legacy. It's not as if Ted Kennedy had been elected president. So there are episodes in his life that are rich, that needed reporting out, that I want. So I wanted to tell this individual story. But constantly in the course of the book, there are historical currents, whether it's the Jesse Jackson campaigns of 84 and 88, or the rich history of Chicago politics, racial politics in Chicago in particular, the atmosphere of Hawaii in the 60s and 70s, all these various historical currents that go on to help shape a man, help shape us, and also help shape his story and the way he tells the story to us, which is a big part of his appeal. So with that preface, with that kind of introduction to what the book is about, or if you want to ask any questions about The New Yorker, which is fine too, why don't we have a conversation? And yes, go ahead.
Hey, if you could just wait for the microphone.
And all the only thing I would ask, because there's a fair number of people here, is that it not be a little speech at, but rather a question.
Okay. Okay. All right. To pick up on a couple of things that you've already alluded to, over his lifetime, Barack Obama has gone by, as far as I can determine, three different names: Barry Sotero, Barry Obama, and Barack Obama. Therefore, since he isn't wedded to a name, why was he so adamant about keeping his middle name of Hussein, which is a very offensive and hot-button issue for, and alludes to a lot?
It's not offensive to me.
Well, it's offensive to me. And I'm a Jew, and it's offensive to me, and it's offensive to a lot of other
Americans.
I'm not
Italian, lady. I got to tell you that.
Well, but the bottom line, it's a legitimate question,
look,
and you know it.
Okay, pass on the microphone. I'll answer your question with respect. I've been known as Dave, alas. I've been called David. I've been called much worse. I am who I am, and there's no question who I am. And there's no question who he is, and it's to his absolute credit that he bears his name, and he bears his name proudly. It's his father's name, Barack Hussein Obama. He has not changed his name, ma'am. When he was young, people called him Barry sometimes. They called him Barack. Some people called him Barack. This happens in people's life. He was hiding nothing from anybody. And a name should not be innately offensive. Ma'am, are you asking me a question? Ma'am?
I think the question has been answered. Let's move on. Let's keep the program going. I have another question.
When they would call, when they would say, "Who is Barack Hussein Obama?" it was done with an intonation of, "Who is this guy? Who is this guy that's not Joe Smith or Joe Fitzgerald or Frank Johnson or, God forbid, Shirley Johnson?" So let's call it by its real name. When statements like that are made from podiums by experienced, pardon the expression, radio talk show hosts, or politicians, or people who are or make insinuations about palling around with terrorists, let's call it by its real name, slander. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. In terms of Barack Obama's actual politics, you know, the left, they say he's too far to the right. The right says he's too far to the left. In your sense of the man, your detailed sense from having met him and having written this extensive book, what do you, you know, where exactly does he lie?
That's a good question.
And how could he change possibly and evolve? You know, he surrounded himself with corporate types on Wall Street, and some people think, well, you
well,
know,
this is, remember,
trying to be practical, but where do you see him, you know, evolving from here in terms of his actual politics?
I think he's, again, I think Skip Gates is right. The most radical thing about him in a historical sense is that he's black and president. In terms of politics, even when he was running in the primary campaign, I mean, there was not a lot of space between him and Hillary Clinton except on one issue, which is the issue that probably won him the Iowa caucuses, which was Iraq. He's a man of the center left in the Democratic Party, period. And he always was. When he was in the State House in Illinois, he was not especially radical. In fact, people to his left in the Black Caucus there couldn't stand him. They couldn't stand him because he was from Harvard, and he was, you know, they saw him as a fancier guy than they were and didn't have deep roots in Chicago. They gave him a lot of a hard time, especially in the beginning, Ricky Hendon, Donnie Trotter, other people in the State Senate. He's a man of the center left. I think it's always been true. I think what we always ignore in these debates is the thing that hides in plain sight. The stated record, the votes, the debates. I don't think there's a gigantic mystery about it. I think, you know, some people change on certain issues. Do I think Barack Obama is a little bit more to the left on certain issues than he lets on? I do, for political reasons. Take gay marriage. Do I believe, really, when Barack Obama goes at home at night, that he gives a damn if gay people get married? I really don't. This may be wishful thinking on my part, and to some extent, therefore, he's a little bit of a Rorschach test. But I think he is a politician. He's not in the prophetic mode. He's not Martin Luther King. He's not someone from the outside pushing in, saying always what he believes absolutely at every minute of the day. He is a politician. And this comes as a great shock to people, and it comes as a great shock, I think, not to be patronizing, to some young people who put so much into the campaign and they're disappointed on certain issues where he is not with them or not with them yet or not with them fully.
Our next question is right down
the
middle.
Oh, I'm sorry. You do it.
All right. It's not a question. It's a statement. I just wanted to thank you so much for doing this, that a person of your caliber would do this for Barack and for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. Thank you.
We got somebody up in the front.
In your reporting, did you learn about what type of political advice or even legal advice Barack Obama got about the question of natural-born American and citizenship that's come up?
I got to tell you, Barack Obama's birth certificate's available. Go online. It's right there. And so are reports in the local press of his birth. Now, it would require a fantastic conspiracy to engineer that. Let's reel back the camera. What would the conspiracy be? Somebody put fake reports in the local press of this random guy who would then be elected president illegally. The mind reels. Look, I have absolutely no problem with people who attack the President of the United States or disagree ferociously with the President of the United States from left, right, and center, including members of the Tea Party who have their legitimate, I may agree with zero of what they say. That's not the point. But when it spins off into fantasy land, and when it even gets worse than that, I worry for us. It's not the first time it's ever happened in American life. but it is worrisome. Yes.
But with all due respect, sir, there's no citation of authority, as I read the book, on page 55, in which you state the facts of the birth, right, or in the footnotes on page 595, supporting the paragraph, no citation of authority whatsoever, including the alleged birth certificate on the web,
to support your
interpretation of the
it's
facts.
It's not an
interpretation
of the facts. Here's the thing. If you read a biography of Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Roosevelt or whomever, I swear to God there will not be a citation to their birth certificate.
You made reference to the new young minority block voting. Do you think
not
that
block voting? I would never say it's
okay,
the block.
Well, that there's this movement,
and there are young
trend.
Conservatives. I have no desire to lump everybody.
So,
together.
Do you think that Obama is a politically transformative figure, like a Roosevelt or I guess a Ronald Reagan? And I guess on the other end, how would you characterize new voters today,
given
the last election?
Well, I wouldn't know how to do the latter. But I think partly you have to, you know, the most boring thing you can say about that, and unfortunately it's probably the most apt, is we'll see. We'll see. But it seems to me that if in the first year of your presidency you've appointed the first Hispanic to the court, that you have, for all intents and purposes, been a part of and led a rescue of a potentially catastrophic collapse of the financial system and the automobile industry, if you have first and foremost added 30 million plus people to the health reform rolls, that's not the worst start in the world. Now, what it'll be after 4 years or eight, I don't know. I don't stand up here as a tribune for Barack Obama. My job tomorrow when I get in the office as an editor, as a journalist, as somebody working with Seymour Hersh or Jane Mayer or George Packer, is to put pressure on power, intellectual and reporting pressure, not to go about endorsing it or to sing its, you know, tra-la-la praises. So I don't stand up for facts, whether it's on the birthing situation or not, as a campaign operative. I do it because those are the facts. That's all. So as far as younger voters are concerned, I don't know how to answer that in the deepest sense, but clearly, Obama was very attractive to younger voters, not all younger voters. And the younger voter is, as a gigantic block, was energized as never before or as rarely before in this last election. And it's more diverse. I'm not saying it's necessarily, as a block, liberal by any stretch of the imagination.
David, I just want to read a couple of sentences from the back of your book. It says, "My hope was to write a piece of biographical journalism that, through interviews with his contemporaries and certain historical actors, examined Obama's life before his presidency and some of the currents that helped him to form it." What I'd like to find out is, and you've got an enormous number of names that mm-hmm. you acknowledge that mm-hmm. you have talk to an interview. Have you interviewed anybody from National Review?
Have I interviewed anybody from the National
no.
Review?
I
read
one
the
of
National
the writers,
Review.
Pardon me,
I read
too.
The National Review.
Do you read Commonweal? Did you talk to anybody?
Commonweal, the Catholic magazine.
Yes.
No. Okay. Do I look at it? Very occasionally. Is there a point to that? I will say, sir.
I think that you have a particular slant, and I can see it through your book.
Because I think he was born in Honolulu?
No. The slant was that you are an editor from a particular magazine that has a particular point of view.
I think everybody
were
has.
There any critical, articles from your magazine that I also subscribe to?
You're perfectly right to raise the point. I think everybody in the room, everybody on the street, everywhere has a political point of view. The point is the book fair? Is the book factual? Does the book try to get a sense of the point of view of others where relevant? And I would answer, the answer is yes.
Hello.
Hi.
Could you give us a rough approximation of how much time you spent with Obama and how much of that your writings
I had two interviews with him. in 07 and last January. And what was the other part of the question? Yeah, look, which is more time than Edmund Morris had with Teddy Roosevelt. But look, I wrote a book about the collapse of the Soviet Union. I had some time with Mikhail Gorbachev, who you would have to say is the kind of singular player in that drama, at least through 1991, or maybe Yeltsin or both. I interviewed them both. I derived something out of those interviews. They were fine, but they weren't the essential thing. They really weren't. If Obama had given me more time, would I have taken it? Of course. Am I glad for the time I got? Of course. But I have to say, for example, take the years that he was an organizer. I spent a couple of days with his, just doing nothing but talking with the guy that he was with all the time. And, you know, his mentor there, somebody who spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours with him. I have to say, as a reporter, my experience is that's where the good stuff comes. The principle has something at stake, especially a political principle. And again, I'll take what I can get, but that's really been my experience.
Over the course of your research, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about the man?
That's a great question. What's the most surprising thing I learned about the man? Well, you know, I think that there's no question, because of the historical aspect of this race, no pun intended, that sometimes it got forgotten just what he was as a politician, a street politician, somebody who acted according to the laws of the way politics are lived in a place like Chicago. And I'm very proud of the fact that the New Yorker, I really thought, was the first place to publish a big piece that cleared away the mists and really dug down deep on how Obama came to be a public man at all in 1995-96 when he first ran for state senate. And the more I investigated into there, I found that the details of that, the kind of granular detail of that, fascinating. I also think, you know, for all the, you know, you read in his autobiography, and you'd read even more detail here about the trials and tribulations he had to go through. This is also a guy who benefited from enormous good fortune. I mean, I'm sure some of you or a lot of you are aware of this, but let's review the case on the first real big-time campaign that he wins. And by the way, I think the first time that Barack Obama really had a very competitive race, really competitive, was the Iowa caucuses. It's amazing, because he ran for Congress in 2000, and he got destroyed. He made a really odd decision to run against a very popular guy named Bobby Rush on the south side of Chicago, and he was beaten by more than 2-1. It was quite clear to his wife, at least, that his political career was over. Michelle lost that argument temporarily. And in 2004, he took one last flyer, and he decided to run for Senate. Why? Because he realized, you know what, I am not a traditional black older politician. I'm not going to be either a big city mayor or a congressman like Bobby Rush. I'm going to go statewide, and it's a state that's very diverse. The farther you go south, the more the political culture begins to feel southern. So here's what happens just to review the record, what happens to Obama in 2004. He is behind in the Democratic primary, and he is being outspent by a gazillion to one, approximately, by a man named Blair Hull, who made all his money first by being a card counter in blackjack, and then making a whole lot of money in financial services. Blair Hull is spending more money than Mike Bloomberg. And not really. Nobody spends more money than Mike Bloomberg. But close. And then Blair Hull's divorce records came open. And let's just say they did not reveal him to be a sterling husband. He goes south, that's it. Obama wins the Democratic race. And he showed a lot of skill in that thing. Then, fortune stroke number two, he gets a phone call from Boston: will you be the speaker at the 2004 Boston Convention? He's a state senator. Who here can name their state senator? No hands, three hands. Exactly. And by the way, those of you who can should be ashamed of yourselves. Political nerds. He gets that, and he gives a speech, and he gives a great speech, and he's now a national figure. He's bringing in, taking in more money in his campaign than he could possibly spend at this point. And his Republican rival, handsome, smart, made a fortune at a certain investment bank that had a very bad week this week. Okay, he made a fortune, but then he started giving tons of money to charity, and he went to teach at a Christian Brothers school. He's a decent person, intelligent conservative. His divorce records come over, and they're even worse. French sex clubs, whips change, whatever. He is out. Who does Obama, you all remember who Obama ran finally against in some? Alan Keyes. Okay, if you can't beat Alan Keyes in American politics, there's something wrong with you. Alan Keyes is there really, the first time he'd ever been in Illinois is for the Senate race. And so he becomes a senator, and I swear to God, the next morning, the press conference, every single question is, when are you running for president? That is a strange career. So,
given what you've learned about Obama and American politics in researching your great book, what would you say is the greatest worry that you have regarding him being a successful president for the best interests of America and the world at this stage?
Well, I can't. I hesitate to even mention it because it's depressing even to mention it. I worry about safety issues. But let's put that to one side and hope it never is never a consideration from anybody. There are political issues now that have no great answer. That a man of Obama's abilities or anybody's abilities have no ready great answer. Take Iran. Iran is on the path to becoming a country with nuclear weapons. At the same time, its stated state ideology is terrifying. Its Holocaust denial, its aggression, its activities in that part of the world are aggressive. And to say the least, and what it can do or will do are far more unpredictable than anything suggested by the great superpowers of the Cold War and post-war era, and that was bad enough. What are the options? The options are, so far, nothing, which is a very bad option. Sanctions, which will not necessarily work. In the history of the world, sanctions rarely get their stated objective. Or attack, either from the United States or Israel or both in concert, and the consequences of that seem to me also terrifying. So no quantity of intelligence, skill, charm, or whatever the capacities of any president would be ensure a good outlook there. And there are many such issues. Sorry to bum you out, but that's what I think about.
There's a delicious irony to the title, which is getting more ironic almost every day. And given your perspective as a former Post reporter, are things worse now, more divisive than ever, or is that just the news needing something to really drum up every day?
Is what worse?
The division in Congress, the joke that bipartisan is becoming. Bipartisan.
Well, I don't think there was. I think this was Barack Obama's self-regard, his political self-regard, was built upon, and if you read it in the second book, it's all throughout there, his capacity to bridge people's political opinions. So when he became, I don't want to be too much of a psychobiographer, but when he became, when he was elected president of the Harvard Law Review, he was elected not just because he got liberal votes, but he got all the conservative votes. He got all the kids that were in the Federalist Society to vote for him because they felt listened to. They knew that he didn't agree with them. They knew he was far more liberal than they. But they felt listened to, whereas the other liberal candidate, when it came down to the finals, did not have that capacity, or not nearly as much as Obama. And if you read The Audacity of Hope, Obama's second book, the more prescriptive, the more conventional book, there are constant moments when he's talking about well, we Democrats are paying a terrible price for lumping all evangelical Christians, for example, in one camp as if we can't talk to them. Well, in fact, it's a much more diverse population, and there's Rick Warren, there's not just Pat Robertson, et cetera, et cetera. And he does that in a lot of instances. And his confidence in his own ability to do this is enormous. I think when he was introduced to the reality of the U.S. Senate, his confidence in that had to plummet. You remember the whole drama of the healthcare debate was that he was going to get Republican votes or at least Olympia Snow and four or five others. That never panned out. And, you know, that bill was passed. If anything, his conciliatory skills were exercised on conservative Democrats, so-called blue dog Democrats. So, that had to have taken a big blow. That's the reality of now. And by the way, a divisive Washington, a divided Washington or Senate or Congress is not a new thing. It's just that the mood of it is so deeply amplified by and made hysterical by the accompanying media that happened. This is natural. It's the world we live in. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that anybody turn the dial off on either the internet or cable television. It's just the reality of now. I think the lady with the microphone is the one that controls it. Sorry.
You actually set the stage for my question.
Sure.
During the campaign, he used to be very diplomatic when it comes to taking on his critics. He used to, I was disappointed that he was not giving them left and right.
Right.
Lately, he has started calling a spade a spade. He has started calling liars liars. And yesterday's Wall Street Journal editorial was very upset about it. It says that he must leave it to surrogates. It is unbecoming of a president. These are my words.
Look, let's be clear. He's being very tough on a particular issue where there's a populist point to be won. Right? We're talking about financial reform, and the banks, love them or hate them, are at this very particular moment not the hardest target in the world, and it also accrues to the votes that he can get from both sides of the aisle on this financial reform thing. The Wall Street Journal... politically, I think we read the same editorial this morning, sides a great deal more with the banks than Barack Obama does. I think I got that right.
I'm afraid this is our last question of the
sure.
evening.
I just wanted to ask, on a more upbeat fantasy?
An upbeat fantasy?
Yes.
Are you sure you're going to say this in public?
Yes.
Okay.
What?
Just us two here.
What sort of a Supreme Court justice do you think he might make in about a decade?
What Supreme Court justice will he make in a decade?
What sort of a Supreme Court justice do you think he might make in a decade?
In a decade?
In about a decade. I'd like to see him, a Supreme Court justice.
Oh! Sorry. It's your fantasy. I was hoping for something else. In all due respect, I don't know. And let's not overestimate his deep experience as a law professor. He was an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago. He was a popular one. Students liked him, but this is not somebody who spent 15 years on the bench or on the faculty of the University of Chicago full time. He wrote nothing. It's not inconceivable. I mean, presidents talk all the time about their desire to pluck somebody from the political world sometimes and put them on the bench, which has precedent, of course, in the history of the Supreme Court. But in conventional terms, that's not usually what presidents do. They pick a jurist, somebody with somebody that's on the Court of Appeals or more rarely from academia. So, who knows? I think more of a media concern is who's going to pick for the bench next week. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out.